Oh, this is the signature story of Chernobyl to me, is the triumph of forest over man's creation, even to the extent of man's radioactive creation.
This is The Butterfly Effect, a podcast that shows the big impact a small action can do. Tali Orad is talking to those special people that make a difference with nature and trees.
Welcome everyone to The Butterfly Effect. My name is Tali Orad. I'm your host and your butterfly here. My special guest today is Dr. James Downer. James has 37 years of experience as a horticulture and plant pathology advisor with the University of California Cooperative Extension in Ventura County. His research is focused on mulch, soil biodiversity, and diseases suppression in mulch soils, diseases of shade trees, and cultural practices to maintain landscape plants. Dr. Downer is an adjunct professor at California Polytechnic University in Pomona. He has a love of shade trees, shinrin-yoku, woodworking, horses, as well as the study of plants and their biology. Welcome, James, to the Butterfly Effect.
Good morning, Tali. It's great to be with you here today.
I'm excited. So you're an expert in horticulture and plant pathology, and I'm thinking, before we dive into anything, can you just explain
Sure.
what it means?
When I was a small child, I was very interested in horticulture. Not initially, but my mom dragged me to a vegetable gardening class when I was 8 years old, and then after that, it was all over. And I took every class that youth education program offered and eventually went to college to learn more, academic things about horticulture. And after a while, I found myself, I'd always been interested in microscopes and looking at things. And of course, plant pathology really does a lot of that. We look at how pathogens invade plants and how the disease happens in plants.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got really interested in that in my undergraduate degree and stayed on for a master's degree in plant pathology at Cal Poly Pomona. And then I started my work in Ventura, and one thing led to another, and I found myself back in a PhD program learning more about plant pathology. So plant pathology, of course, is the study of how plants get diseased and the causes of disease.
This is interesting, and I understand, or I can assume this is what eventually led you to Ukraine after Chernobyl, right? The study that
a far more whimsical story, actually. As I indicated, I went to work in Ventura and then went back to graduate school. I had a colleague who at the same time was doing the same thing, only he was studying atmospheric chemistry at UCLA, and he was located in Bakersfield. But he was also a horticulture advisor, and he had a penchant for doing gardening tours around the world. And he was very much interested in the environmental science surrounding the Chernobyl nuclear zone. And he talked to me and he said, "Hey, let's go there. They just opened this thing up. We can go there." And it just sounded so far out and crazy in 2012 when we were doing this that I just went for it and went with my colleague, John, who really was the guy who started it all, John Karlick.
Wow, that's a very crazy, if I may say, and very brave. So what can you tell us about?
Yeah. Okay, so if you think back to 2010, 2000, Y2K, that time between 2000 and 2010, in Chernobyl, there was a military exclusion zone around the reactor site. Nobody was allowed in and out. And there were coming through the sort of the beginnings of social media then, these news reports of people getting on motorcycles and bonsaiing through the zone to see what was in there. And there were like video clips you could find on the internet, and it was all very secretive and like scary. These people were so daring, and they were going through there, and it was like, wow, who would do that? That's just crazy. And around 2010, some things started to change in Ukraine, and by 2011, they had opened the nuclear exclusion zone to tour, And so you could legally go in there. And a company started called Chernobyl Tours with our good friend Sergei Mirny. And Sergei was one of the guys in the Soviet Army who was on the ground when the explosion happened. And he was involved in radiation monitoring and detection before the Soviet Union became Ukraine. By 2012, he was up and going. And John Karlik knew him from his contacts at Central European University, where he's an adjunct professor. And we got together with Sergei, and we were like one of the early tours when they had, you know, cheap minivans. And they got better over time. But
so you and John and Sergei, so what did you find? What did you see there?
We saw abandonment. We saw a post-apocalyptic wilderness with 200 villages that had been evacuated, and the town of Pripyat, the workers' town that once held 50,000 people that now held ghosts and nobody. And we saw trees. There's trees everywhere in the zone. And we saw people selling mushrooms on the way into the zone, which was kind of frightening. And we saw all kinds of things. It was an amazing experience in 2012 because we were eyes wide open. And it's like, this is really creepy. And when you go there, you get to the first gatepost, guard post at the 30-kilometer circle. And these really stern-looking military dudes come out and they check your passport. They look at the papers. They see if you're on the list. There's like talking going on with Sergei and those guys, and I don't know what, and it's creepy, right? Yeah. And they got machine guns, and it's super creepy. And then you get to the 10-kilometer exclusion zone. Now you're getting closer to the reactor. You go through this again. You get checked out. They look at the papers, and then you're allowed forward. And then you come to the town of Chernobyl, which is not, by the way, near the reactor. The town of Chernobyl is 1,000 years old, and it has abandoned buildings. It was a village, of course, a small town, and it had people living there before the disaster, and mostly nuclear workers. And the zone administration offices are there. But the reactor complex is really a kilometer further away. And so Sergei took us all around to all the sites. He took us there. He took us to the cafeteria at the reactor plant where the workers eat, you know, food there every day at the cafeteria.
Yeah.
And that was a cool experience, you know.
Right.
We go there and Sergei goes, be sure to get extra bread. Get a lot of bread with your meal. And I mean, this is a hearty meal, very balanced. You got like a beet soup, borscht, and you got bread.
Mm-hmm.
You got some kind of meat thing. You got salad. You get in this whole tray. And then you get a cup of this starch drink, which everybody was shocked at. What's this? It's like so thick it pours like syrup, starch.
Mm-hmm.
That was keeps you going, I guess, in the radiation.
Ouch.
So we get done with our meal there at the cafeteria at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. And you walk outside, and very close by is a bridge over the cooling pond outflow from the reactor. And you look over the bridge, and there are these gigantic catfish swimming down in the canal. And you throw the bread down for them to eat, and they come up in a big froth. And these things are as long as people. They're gigantic.
Wow.
Yeah. And we got another tour out there where we found out that there was actually a real aquaculture thing happening there before the reactor disaster. They were growing like 20 different kinds of fish in the cooling pond. And the idea was to harvest these to eat them, which sounds kind of like, why would they do that? But they weren't afraid of radiation then.
Right.
They are now.
Of course. Yeah. So what was one thing that surprised you that you not expecting to see? Well, besides now the fish thing.
Oh, the fish thing was a surprise, yeah. I think the dogs of Chernobyl were a surprise. There's an article about the genetic diversity of the dogs of Chernobyl. It just came out this week, and it talks about how they're a distinct variety. Well, they've been captured in the zone for almost 40 years, so They've been breed. There's an 800 dog breeding population, and these dogs would be found all through the zone and in Pripyat, living kind of feral, and they are very unique looking. I guess another interesting finding was that, as we look around, one of the things that was known for the area was the red forest, and you hear this in accounts of the Chernobyl disaster. Oh, there was a red forest. And it's like, I was so looking forward to seeing this forest of red trees, which was silly. I should have known better, being a plant pathologist and really understanding pine trees pretty well, that that's what happens to them when they just die. So
yeah.
If a pine tree dies of a bark beetle or any other condition and it dies rapidly, it turns yellow and then it turns kind of red colored, then brown. So when the disaster happened, the radiation was swept away to the west of the reactor and in a concentrated band, and the Scots pine forest that was planted there got dosed with about 20 grays of radiation. And that is enough to kill plant life. And it killed the trees massively, suddenly, and they all turned red. And that's why they called it the Red Forest.
Right.
So when you go to the Red Forest today, there's not really a forest. There's a bunch of young Scots pines coming up here and there and other things in grassland. And they say, oh, here's the Red Forest.
Yeah.
It's where the Red Forest was, but it is not any longer the Red Forest.
So the forest is...
kind of a surprise.
Yeah, and so the forest is regenerating itself, right? Without it.
Oh, this is the signature story of Chernobyl to me, is the triumph of forest over man's creation, even to the extent of man's radioactive creation. And basically the forest wins. The forest is retaking that whole area, and including the abandoned city of Pripyat. Aside from where active work is going on to like construct radioactive fuel holding facilities and things such as that, there's active growth of the forest there, and it's very healthy.
So you went there as part of your study on nature there? What was it?
Well, that evolved, actually. So we went there in 2012, just like I said, eyes wide open on a tour with Sergei. We were just tourists. And we got the idea that, you know, there was so much to see. It was so overwhelming that we had to come back. And between 2012 and 2015, I had evolved several ideas about ways we might be able to do some observational research in the zone. And I did not want to go through all the red tape it would take to declare authorized research in the zone. There has been a lot of research that was authorized by the zone authority where scientists study various things. But we have neither the money nor the resources to do that. So we thought, what can we do within the context of one of Sergei's tours to understand better how things have happened in the zone? And a colleague of mine did this without a tour. He came in and wrote a paper about what happened to the original urban forest in Pripyat, the workers' town. And this was Igor Lachin and Joe McBride, his professor, from UC Berkeley. And they gave us a very good preliminary view of what the urban forest was in Pripyat. So I started to narrow down an idea that I had, and that was to wonder, how has that abandoned forest dealt with abandonment? Because we think of urban forests as needing care, needing pruning, needing watering, needing all the things that we think trees need. And these trees were a going urban forest one day, and 3 days later they were abandoned for the rest of their lives.
Right.
And so we came up with an idea. We would come back with other people. We had usually small groups, 5 to 10 people who came with us that wanted to see Chernobyl. We figured out we could do some observational research by measuring trees of the same age and same species and see what the differences are between the trees that are growing in Kiev, the capital city of Ukraine, and Pripyat, the workers' town. And so that was what we started to do in 2015. And we came back in 2016 and took a few more measurements in 2018 and took some final measurements. So we had about 3 years of growth measurements on these two populations of trees.
So I'm curious about the first concept of the abandoned forest deal with abandonment. What did you find?
Trees love to be abandoned in Ukraine because there is enough water there. If we abandon trees in Los Angeles, they would probably die, right?
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, we're getting less than 10 inches of rain a year, and that's not enough for a lot of trees. But Ukraine gets pretty good rainfall. It's the same in Kiev and Chernobyl,
right.
Same rainfall.
I have to ask you, in terms of biodiversity, sometimes urban forests are really just one type of tree, right? And
that
I'm curious.
That sounds like Ukraine. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm just curious if that abandoned urban forest had any change in the biodiversity.
Yes, it did. And it's a good question, Tali. The propensity in the days of Stalin was to do things very uniformly. And the horse chestnut is the tree of Ukraine. Everywhere you go, there's horse chestnut trees, and in Pripyat as well, and in Kiev still. And so their biodiversity is low. They have several issues with that. They have insect pests, they have pathogens. And because their urban forest is not that diverse, the trees suffer quite a bit. And it turns out that the trees in Chernobyl, specifically in Pripyat, the worker town, those abandoned trees are in better condition architecturally because they haven't been pruned and disease and pest-wise. And another interesting finding from our visits was all the trees in Chernobyl are covered in lichen, but the trees in Kiev are not. There's no lichen in Kiev. There's way more pollution from automotive exhaust and other things. The trees in the zone are doing well. Now, another factor on this is that radiation can kill things, and radiation can also retard the growth of things plant-wise.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some published work looking particularly at Scots pine, because it's the most common thing in the zone.
Mm-hmm.
It showed that Scots pine that were growing in areas of more concentrated fallout grew less than Scots pine growing in areas with less fallout. So we know the radiation generically can slow down the growth of trees. And our data from measuring trees in the two locations seem to suggest the same thing.
Right.
That the trees in Chernobyl are growing slower, but they're growing healthfully. And their architectural structure is way better because they haven't had low-quality tree trimming done to them for 35 years. And so we see fewer branch faults.
Mm-hmm.
Fewer problems with the architecture of the branches and how they're attached.
Right.
And so in that way, the trees are healthier.
That's interesting. And one thing that I know is, first of all, it's better for trees to grow slower than to just rapidly grow, right? It means that they will survive for a longer time. The second thing I wanted to ask you is regarding radiation. I mean, I'm assuming you checked the radiation in the vegetation. Or maybe not, but if you did, did you see less of it?
You have to get a lot into understanding the physics of these processes of nuclear fission.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, when the reactor blew up, a whole bunch of different compounds flew into the air. And many of them, like radioactive iodine and xenon and the gases and stuff, have very short half-lives. In 6 days, it was half gone. In 12 days, half of that was gone. A month later, it's mostly all gone, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there are other elements, like strontium and cesium, that have 30-year half-lives. So by the time we get there, 30 years later, pretty close to 30 years in 2012,
mm-hmm.
the upset was in 1986.
Yeah.
about half of those radionuclides were gone. Now, plutonium lasts 20,000 years, half-life.
Mm-hmm.
But the amount of plutonium that fell from the explosion is way less than the amount of cesium and strontium. So the principal nuclides that are causing radiation in the zone are cesium and strontium. Half of their radiation is gone. In another 30 years, half of that will be gone. And it degrades half-life at a time, right?
Right.
So when you go into the zone and you turn on your detector, you can measure the number of emissions. That these detectors are like measuring photons. Mm-hmm. Radiation is a particle that is emitted when the element decays. And so this energy is given off. It's called gamma radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And so the gamma radiation is picked up in the detector as a blip. It's like the old ticking Geiger counter, tick, 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 tick.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all particles being emitted from the decaying nuclide. When we go into the zone, we measure that gamma radiation, and it's about 10 times more than the background radiation in Kiev, which is similar to the rest of the world.
Right.
And so it's about 10 times higher. And it is still not high enough to really harm you walking around in there. The thing that John and I like to tell people is that our flight to Ukraine dosed us with more radiation than the 2 days we spent walking around in the nuclear exclusion zone.
Yeah.
Because when you're up in the upper atmosphere, you have very little shielding from the gamma radiation.
Yeah.
And so every airplane flight gives you more of a dose than 2 days in the zone.
Yeah.
So that kind of puts it in perspective.
Of course. Okay, now, you mentioned at the beginning when in your first trip there were people selling mushrooms, and it's just...
Yeah.
I'm just curious. I know Ukraine is a country that grows a lot of crops. It's a farmer's country. And
yes.
I know there was the cloud of radiation that went west. And I'm just curious if there is any effect on vegetation and crops in those areas.
Principally, no, because the part of the zone that had the most fallout has that 30-kilometer exclusion fence around it.
Yeah.
So even when you go in there and look around, you can't see anything that looks any different than anywhere else in Ukraine.
Right.
Except that this is a wild place that's become a nature reserve, really. And the vegetation doesn't look any different. So the impact on plants is not the same as the impact on people. Plants, for instance, don't get malignancies and tumors and kind of, quote, cancer that we would get as humans.
Right.
And so the exposure to the pollutants is different for plants than it is for people.
Okay, so for a sci-fi fan, movie sci-fi fan, I'm just curious. So all those things that we'll see in those areas where the plants look different, bigger, smaller, weird uh-huh. shaped, different colors, that's not going to be the case?
No, that's not the case. I'm sorry. You wouldn't, as a layperson, you wouldn't see the difference.
Okay.
But what you do see is really shocking things. Like when you go to Pripyat, they had a sports center with a football field and a track around it and a stadium. And when you go out there, you walk onto it, you are walking through a forest on the football field.
Wow.
Because the trees have all invaded that spot. And you don't really perceive that it's a stadium until you come to the other end and you see the bleachers. And then
wow.
you see the remnants of the track. That shows you how in 30 years the forest has taken everything back.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a weird forest too, because it's not a forest of native trees. The forest in Ukraine is largely synthetic. And by that I mean it's poplars and locust trees and Scots pine trees. And these things aren't necessarily native to that area.
Mm-hmm.
It's not oak trees and the kind of things that you might suspect.
Right.
These are all the weedy species of trees that are just growing around, and they take over. They're growing in the cracks of the buildings, so they're taking the buildings apart. There were schools that I walked through in 2016 that in 2018 I could no longer do that because the floors had been collapsed from the roof where trees had grown between the walls.
Oh, wow.
And basically taken down the building. Wow. It's phenomenal.
Yeah.
But I have to say, the Soviets envisioned Pripyat as the most premier workers' community in the entire Soviet Union. This was the best place you could be. This was modern. It had culture. It had cafes. It had everything. And the 16-story apartment buildings that are in Pripyat stand strong. They're still all standing. There's no problem with those guys. And you can walk up those things, they've been abandoned, to the top and get on the roof and look out over the zone and see the massive forest that's come in. Birch trees, pine trees, locust trees, etc. Not so much horse chestnut trees. They're not quite so invasive.
Okay. Now, unfortunately, Chernobyl in 1986 wasn't the last nuclear accident. And on March 11, 2011, right, we had Fukushima nuclear power station suffered major damage. And that was after a magnitude of 9, right, earthquake and subsequent tsunami. And I think it was the largest civilian nuclear accident since Chernobyl. And first of all, would like to acknowledge 20,000 people that were dead. But we're here focusing on the environment. And I'm just curious if you can talk a little bit about the environmental impact. I know you did not study Japan, but I'm just curious if you know of any environmental implication, right? Comparing them both.
I think the big environmental implication is that Fukushima plant was on the ocean, and the ocean was being used for cooling the reactors, and so the majority of the spillage went into the ocean. And that is environmentally is a huge disaster that is beyond the Chernobyl disaster in scope in a way. But let me back up a bit, because let's put things in perspective. When the Chernobyl nuclear power plant blew up, it increased the global background radiation by 2%. That is the entire planet, because this stuff went in the air and it went everywhere around the globe.
Mm-hmm.
And the amount of radionuclides or radiation that was released in Chernobyl is roughly about 10 times the amount that was released in Fukushima.
Wow.
So the Chernobyl disaster was larger. It was different because it wasn't spread by water so much as by air.
Mm-hmm.
I can't really say which is environmentally more destructive, because I don't think we know.
Right.
The Chernobyl disaster has had a lot of study. There are a couple of books that are Chernobyl 20 years later, Chernobyl 25 years later, that are full of research papers about findings of the disaster.
Right.
And those things are being evolved now at Fukushima. People are gaining perspective on what it means. And I haven't read a lot of the Fukushima work,
mm-hmm.
so I don't know the details of it, but I do find some interesting parallels.
Right.
One of them is that there's a whole story about the self-settlers, and these are the people who came back to Chernobyl to go back to their farm, to go back to their house and live in the zone, even though they weren't allowed to.
Mm-hmm.
And the government put up with them, and they even started to support them in Chernobyl. And the same thing has happened in Fukushima. People have said, you know, I know it's contaminated, but I'm going to go back and live there.
Yeah,
and
it's their
home. I find that interesting.
Yeah, it's people's homes, right? You're connected somehow. And
it's
hard
to live.
Yeah.
And the pictures I've seen of the area around Fukushima are very beautiful. It's a beautiful environment. I can see why they would want to return. But it may not, at this, it's so fresh, I think.
Yeah.
It may not be a wise thing to do.
Right. And it seems like, so people are thinking of, I mean, the people that live there thinking of restoring, and I'm just wondering if there's any discussion on restoration or rehabilitation, either if the ecosystem or the environment in those zones.
I think the ecosystem is resilient, at least in terms of enduring radioactivity.
Mm-hmm.
People less so. because we count our losses in every cancer and every sickness that happens. And the ecosystem doesn't regard life that way. Things will change. Some organisms may be less prominent, others certainly more prominent. And it's a selective pressure radiation that'll have some sort of impact on the ecosystem. But the ecosystem will move forward, as it always does, and adapt to the circumstance. It's a little bit more difficult for people.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, for me, it reminds me of the entire concept of climate change and global warming.
It's a same parallel, except, of course, global warming is everywhere.
Of course, and then, yeah, the effect on people versus Mother Earth will regenerate itself. It's just a question, where will we be as we are so fragile?
Mother Earth has endured catastrophes, the degree of which we have no scale or concept to understand, and may endure more at our hands. That's hard to say. We all worry about that. I worry about it, but something will probably still be happening here long after people are not happening here.
Yeah, let's hope we can still do something. So what would be the number one takeaway from being there, witnessing, seeing all of that for you?
I think for me it is that the forest has the most tremendous ability to regenerate itself. It may not be the forest you are used to, it may be a different forest, but trees are resilient. And they don't need us to take care of them in that environment.
In your profession, what is the one common myth about either diseases or soil or the trees that you want to debunk?
I guess the number one myth to debunk is that trees don't need to be pruned. People need to prune trees. From the tree's point of view, they don't need pruning. And I think that's a big one, because people pay for such terrible things that happen to trees, and then they call that horticulture or tree maintenance or something. And at the end of the day, the Chernobyl study proves that you don't need to prune trees. They can take care of themselves in determining where their branches grow. And, you know, the corollary of that is people need to prune. Well, people need a view, they need clearance, they need sunlight coming through the tree, they need. But people's needs are not the same as trees' needs. And so we should step back from the idea that we have to control their growth, because we don't. They will grow their tree body into what their genetic plan has for them.
So it will
be good.
I will be the advocate for just 1 second and say, okay,
oh, sure.
I get the view and I get all those things, but sometimes they grow close to electricity pole or something like that, or you worry that in the next storm branches will fall and hit pedestrians or cars or whatever. Is that the same case? You still against pruning there?
I'm not against pruning. I just want you to realize why you're doing it. So it's not that the trees in those circumstances want to be pruned.
Right.
It's that we want to make the tree safe. Okay, then we can engage on that, and we can talk about what makes a tree safe in a circumstance. And actually, that's very surprising, too. The kind of pruning we do to make a tree safe has changed. We've done a lot of research on that, and just pruning it any old which way isn't necessarily going to make it more safe. It turns out that the branches of trees absorb energy, and so these long branches waving around in the wind are actually dampening the energy that's hitting the tree. And when you prune them back, you take away that ability to absorb the energy, and you can actually increase their failure rate. And so it's not as obvious as we once thought it was. And the research on this is compelling.
So it's
actually a lot more to it than that, but we are beginning to understand that trees grow in a way that they do for ways that they need to do that. And when we get in there and muck it up, then the outcome isn't always what we want, even when we think we're pruning them for a certain reason.
Yeah, Fascinating.
So, yeah.
Okay. So what is your favorite tree?
Quercus rugosa, which is the netleaf oak, which grows here in southern Arizona in the Chiricahua Mountains. And it grows in Mexico, in Texas and around. But it's a very drought-hardy tree that is spectacular. It has red leaves when they first grow new, and then they turn green. And they're the texture of hard cardboard. Very interesting tree.
Nice. And it's exactly the opposite of the red woods in Chernobyl, which the red is here, is it's growing versus the red is there when it's dying.
Yes, this is a red that signals lush new growth, not death.
Yes.
And that's an interesting metaphor.
Yeah, and on that positive note, I would like to thank you, James, for joining me today and for sharing everything that you've been working on.
It's fun, Tali. I hope we can do it again. And I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
And thank you, everyone, for joining me today. We are all beautiful butterflies, each in his and her individual ways. I wanted to thank you for joining me today in this episode. I really appreciate you coming on this journey with me, and I hope you can join me next time. And remember, it only takes a small action to make a big difference. Be a butterfly.
And that's all for this episode. Thank you for joining us today. Please subscribe to hear more of our stories of change.